It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello and welcome to the Wizen Cricket Weekly podcast. Welcome to 2023. We've got lots lined up in today's show. There's Pakistan, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, a couple of England Lions squad announcements, some controversial moments in the Big Bash. And off the back of that, the interview you've all been waiting for. Ben talks to Fraser Stewart, the man who's essentially in charge of the MCC's laws. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is Phil Walker and Ben Gardner. Mark Butcher will be joining us later in the show. I didn't mention it in the intro, but the biggest piece of news in the World Game this week was the shocking news of the quite frankly horrific car crash that Rishabh Pant was involved in. Phil, we should just be grateful that he's alive, really.
Chilling, really genuinely chilling. Approximately 5:30 in the morning, on the morning of December the 30th, he was driving home alone along the Delhi Expressway to see his mum, to visit his mum. And he fell asleep at the wheel, dozed off, as the quote is, at the wheel for a moment. Car hit the road divider, flipped itself over twice, and he somehow managed to have the presence of mind and the physical strength to smash, to shatter the windscreen and haul himself out of it moments before the car exploded and caught fire. He was then rushed to hospital in Dehradun. He was stabilised over the next few days. Remarkably, the MRI scans showed that his spine and brain were normal. So, I mean, God, thank heavens for that. And then he, after 4 days, he was airlifted to a hospital in Mumbai for urgent surgery on one of the two tears in his knee ligament area. So, look, it's maybe a somber way to start the show and in the first week of the new year, but this really does, all the cliches, it puts everything in perspective. And I was actually writing about him, this is weird, but I was writing about him without knowing what had happened to him. So I was writing about him on the 30th of December, and he was in our test team of the year for last year for the upcoming magazine. And, you know, you write about his 146 against England and, you know, what a game changer he is and whether he can take on Gilchrist's record one day and, you know, what a unique talent he is and all that sort of stuff. And you write about these people in this little bubble of this sort of impenetrable bubble of joy, you know, nothing could ever happen to swerve it off. And then weirdly, an hour or two later, I went online and found what had happened. Heard what happened to him, and I don't know. I it's too early in the year to be profound, but it was really quite shocking for the whole game. And it goes without saying that you know, we all just pray that he returns in full health at some point down the line. On that, there is no time frame. Of course, there isn't. I think any hope that he features against Australia in a few months' time, or even in the IPL, sounds probably optimistic. But you never know. At this juncture,
but it almost feels weird speculating about it.
Just thank the heavens that he managed to get out of that car that was about to blow any second after he managed to crawl himself across the road. There was two Indian chaps who were particularly heroic in helping him get to hospital in time. It was a bus driver who was heading out at 4:30 in the morning and saw it happen, and and ran to his aid. So look, it's a truly, truly chilling story, really. And as I say, we just hope that he makes a full recovery.
Absolutely. Back to the cricket. In the last week, we've got two test series going on, Pakistan, New Zealand and Australia, South Africa. At the time of recording, the second Pakistan-New Zealand test is in its fourth day. It's fairly even at the moment on a slightly quicker pitch than what we've seen previously this Pakistani summer. Pakistan have Nassim Shah and Hassan Ali back in the side. Nassim Shah in particular has looked really good. Sal Shakeel scored a really, really slow 100 that was kind of understandable given the match scenario, but his innings has taken a lot of time out of the game. Ben, in the first test, there was a very strange declaration from Babar Azam that I'm still not quite sure why he did it. So New Zealand scored 600, Kay Williams scored a double ton. Pakistan then looked to have been playing for the draw. Then with 15 overs left in the test match, Babar declares with New Zealand needing 138 to win with a maximum of 15 overs left. You're not going to take 10 wickets in 15 overs. You might score 114 in 15 overs. Why has he done it?
Well, it is weird. I think when you look at why he's done it, I think it's hard to avoid the influence of England and Ben Stokes. Don't want to draw everything back to them. But when you see a team beat you 3-0 playing in that manner, you're going to
give it a go. It wasn't just bold declarations, that's true, it was setting it up.
He hasn't copied the homework completely right, but I think that must be, and when you see the noise from, you know, from Ramiz Raja, who was in charge at that time, saying, you know, we need to follow this style, we need to be more proactive. And I mean, he's sort of got it wrong. I would also, the weird thing is, I'd understand it if he'd spoken differently about it after the game, because the game, actually, it was safe at that point. Like, if you look at when the sun was going to go down, when bad light was going to come into play, there was no way they were going to get those 15 overs in. So actually, it was a completely safe declaration from all points of view. So if he just said, like, look, the game was safe, we knew we could bring on the quicks and slow the run scoring down if we absolutely needed to, and we'd done enough batting and fancied having a bit of a bowl for a bit, and who knows what will happen, that would have made sense. It was more that he seemed like he genuinely thought they had a chance of, like, even a 1% chance of victory when it was so much more than that. Only once in test history has a team been bowled out in fewer than 15 overs, which is what they had to do. And that was not, I imagine, on a pitch like this with the quality of batting that New Zealand have, having scored big runs in the first innings. So yeah, it was weird. I think that took a bit of the pressure off how New Zealand approached that game and that day as well. So Pakistan had basically saved the test by that point, as it eventually proved. But there was no sort of like Cardiff 2009 vibes to the end of that thing, even though Pakistan only had two wickets left. It was very, like, the whole game basically, and maybe this just feels more stark given what happened on the previous test series played in Pakistan, but it was played very much as if, you know, if a chance to win presents itself, we might try and take it, as New Zealand did. They did bat very aggressively in that short period before bad light came, but there wasn't really much of an effort by either side before that point to make it happen. New Zealand, even when they got quite far ahead, weren't going particularly quickly at any point. I know it is always hard to work out, especially in those third innings when there's runs at play and a lead at play, and also you want to target the weaker batter. But you kind of think that when you've got two wickets to get, having a completely spread field for basically four balls of every over can't be the quickest way to do that and to get into your chase and then try and win the game. And that's what was happening. So I actually think that New Zealand's approach was, obviously it was less focused on right then, but it was a weird game from that point of view as well, I guess.
Pakistan have a pretty weird test schedule, so this is the last test match they play at home in 2023. It's been a weird summer for Pakistan, because I think they have actually found a few players who could be the core of a good team in the not too distant future.
But I'm not sure that Babar is the right man to lead them.
We were saying in the office the other day that he doesn't really seem to have that natural grasp of how a cricket match plays out, basically.
No, and there have been many cricketers like him who are beyond gifted, but who seem to have their gifts and their genius contained, quite enclosed. And Babar strikes me as that kind of man. That said, it could well be a case of losing it in translation. You know, his English isn't great, and so me, being ignorant, I don't often get much of a glimpse into his inner thoughts. Or perhaps there aren't too many that he's prepared to divulge, because, you know, you would get things would drip along the line, right? You would get some sense of him, but he remains this peculiar enigma in the world game. And nobody really knows too much about him. So you go on what you see on the pitch. You go on these little details and little clues. And what you saw when he came up against England, albeit came up against this sort of juggernaut, he was remarkably passive, I thought, and tactically very timid, and selectorially as well, very self-defeating, really. You know, some of those bowlers that they were up against it with Shaheen down and with Harris Rao falling away very quickly as well. But some strange choices, I thought. And with Shahid Afridi coming in now as the chairman of selectors, which does raise a smile, if nothing else, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point they say, look, you just be our star and we'll hoist the captaincy onto the shoulders of somebody like Shaan Masood, right, who is, you know, a little bit more of a rounded individual. While he's maybe not the most naturally talented of players, he's made something of himself. He's made some good test hundreds. He's back in that side at three in this current test side. And perhaps it might just be best for Bubba, whose record as a skipper is not great. You know, they're behind the eight ball in this New Zealand game, although they might still pull it out the bag on day five. Obviously, they went down against Australia. They got beat 3-0 at home against England. So it may well be at the end of this test match that they just have a quiet word with one another. But you know, we shall see. But it's odd how limited they are in the test game at the moment. Albeit, as you say, there are some players coming through that you think they can hang the future on.
Shaan Masood's innings, by the way, my moment of the week. So it's actually quite
an 11 ball 20.
Yeah, at number three. Mm. Actually, quite a good illustration of your description of him as a test player. So I think he got the strategy absolutely right. So the best chance of Pakistan winning that game is them to score quickly. Ajaz Patel came on and he was like, right, I'm going to hit him out of the attack. Hits him with three boundaries in an over. And then Patel probably bowls the worst ball of the over. It's short and wide, outside off stump. Tries to cut it. He does cut it, but it goes straight to point. Right shot to play. Terrible execution, and it actually kind of showed he does understand how the game works really well, but he's not quite got the execution of a top batter.
I think one of the issues with Babar staying in the role as captain, like, there was a clip that went round of Shahid Afridi, and in it he essentially acknowledged that Babar is not yet a great captain, essentially.
Right.
But there is just a lack of alternatives, essentially. Like, Shaan Masood is the one that sort of stands out.
But there's no other established player around that kind of age, is there?
Yeah, and I actually think that Shaan Masood probably isn't in Pakistan's best side as it stands. And if you look at his record since he's come back into the side, he's yet to make a score above 30. But then beyond him, who are you looking at? You've got Shafiq is very young and going through a little poor patch of his own at the moment. Imam Mahak possibly, but there are questions about him anywhere outside.
He's basically never done well outside Pakistan.
Like, Rizwan, you would have said, is an option, but is currently outside of the side. You've got Shakil, who's very new into the side. You've got Sarfraz, who's new back into the side and obviously not a long-term choice, and that would come with its own baggage with him having been in charge before. And then you're kind of into the bowlers. So I think that's an issue that Pakistan have as well. They either need to take a punt on someone or give it to someone who's maybe established, but you could see them not being in the side for the long haul.
Shaheen's the other option. I know his injury has meant he's not played as much test cricket recently as Pakistan would have liked him to have played, but you know, bowlers are doing all right as test captains elsewhere in the world at the moment, and Shaheen is captain in the PSL. He's such a huge figure in Pakistani cricket. You could see that possibly working.
Yeah, and I think you saw another example of some of the limitations around Babar's captaincy in this test, actually with Sal Menaga, who bowled really well in that first innings.
Yeah, I slagged him off a couple of weeks ago, said I'm not really sure what he did, and then in this test match he's bowled really, really well.
Well, it's weird because I kind of agree with you, except that it didn't look at all like he was sort of overawed or didn't out of place at test cricket. It just didn't really seem what that place was. He was sort of batting at seven, making useful runs, obviously got 100 in the last game, but wasn't bowling at all. So this was the first time in at home, so since the start of the England series, he bowled more than six opens and innings, I think. And it was basically from the sixth over onwards, from the seventh over onwards, was when he started bowling really well. So he clearly benefited loads from actually being able to settle into it, not just being on for one or two overs and then taken off. But the only reason that was happening was because I think Pakistan misread the pitch slightly, or it was not to the instructions that they'd provided. Like, it seemed before the test that they were going to provide a pitch with lots of pace in it, grass on it, that meant that they would be able to pick three seamers and Abra Ahmed could sort of fill in the gaps. And yet it was actually still filled with lots of runs, which meant you had to have someone get through a lot of work, which meant he had to go to Salmanaga, and he ends up bowling really well. But that has happened kind of by accident rather than by design, I think. And that's the main thing that people have been saying about Babar, is that there's often a plan A, but there's no plan B, and he just sticks to that. You know, the spinners that he's got and trusts in, rather than looking around for a creative solution.
The other test match going on at the moment is Australia, South Africa, which is 2 days in and is going pretty much as I think you'd probably expected it to. Australia are very much on top. They're 475 for four. Usman Khawaja is currently 195, not out. Steve Smith got 100. The most interesting thing from that game so far really is that there's been a recall from Matt Renshaw because Cam Green's out. But Renshaw subsequently caught COVID. But nowadays that doesn't matter as much as it did last year. So he's actually out there batting at the moment with Khawaja. Ben, we've already talked a lot about this, how this hasn't been a great series, but you surprised me today by saying South Africa still actually have a pretty good chance of qualifying for the World Test Championship final, even if they lose this test.
Yeah, so if they lose this test, the following combination of results, which isn't that unlikely, so Australia win in India, maybe that's unlikely, but given how Australia are playing in India, a slight lower ball, probably come to that later, that's possible. If Sri Lanka fail to win in New Zealand and Australia and South Africa beat West Indies 2-0, then South Africa could be in the World Test Championship final against Australia. That all could happen. But to be honest, based on how they've gone, I would not be at all surprised if they failed to beat West Indies 2-0. I mean, West Indies acquitted themselves quite well in that Australia tour. And it's not just that West Indies batted better than South Africa have this tour. South Africa's bowling seems like it's declined quite quickly from that first test when they had a helpful pitch and did really well. Like there's
yeah, it's only two test matches though. That's a really, really good attack.
That's true.
They were brilliant against England in England. And I guess home conditions, they're always very good.
And I guess maybe if their batters are against a line that's struggling more, they might sort of find another level because they'll know they'll be in the game. But it has been stark that this is an attack that should be absolutely brilliant. These are conditions that they should be able to be quite successful in, and they've not managed to do anything like
and
that.
if Sri Lanka were to beat New Zealand 2-0 in New Zealand, huge ask, but Bangladesh went there in January last year and won the first test match, and so Sri Lanka have only lost four of their last 14. Stats won six of those 14 as well. Then they're well in the mix, right?
Yeah, so
that would be astonishing and marvellous, yeah, should they somehow pull
Chris
that
Silver
off.
With Sri Lanka.
Sorry, Chris Silver with Sri Lanka. Frank Lampard, so, Sri Lanka.
Also, sorry that I went to Ben instead of you. This is obviously your areas now as much as Ben's.
No, it's all right, mate. So I will doff my cap to the machine over there.
On South Africa, by the way, I sort of think that maybe, I know Dean Elgar hates it, but they should maybe be trying to baz-ball it a bit. I mean, they can't
get any worse.
Yeah, like, right? They can't bat for any length of time anyway. And they do have like a couple of that sort of like mold of player, like Razzie van der Dussen, for example. In one day cricket, he's a proactive player. He has an absurd average. He's absurdly consistent. And it's not as if he's coming out and swinging from ball one, but he's a shadow of that player in test cricket. And he does seem like one who, if he had maybe a bit more clarity to think, okay, I can just do that thing that I know I'm good at.
I find it actually unwatchable. I find it so painful. And there's such an overwhelming sense of futility to it, really. Knowing that South Africa are not going to be playing another three test series until 2026 at the earliest. Knowing that they have effectively suspended at best their test hopes in order to try and generate some money through their newfangled T20 tournament. Looking at that top six, when you consider the great top sixes that they've had in the past, in the not too distant past as well, I find it quite hard to watch. And as well, I mean, from the other side of it, how many times do you see Australia, you know, with the jackboot on the neck, and they've been doing it more often than not for most of my life, and they always win the toss, and they're always 200 for one by the middle of the afternoon, you know, forever in my nightmares. And it's just been a very painful watch, really. It's hard to know. I think it was one of the boys from Great Cricketer tweeted, are Australia good or is this the death of test cricket? And I find myself sort of swinging, undulating from those two dark thoughts.
We obviously cover the latter quite a lot on the pod, and there's more of that later, don't worry. But I do think we don't give enough credit to actually just how bloody good that Australia top seven is in other conditions.
Like, yeah, fair.
Khawaja averages
fair
48 in Test cricket, and he's what, the fourth or fifth least interesting of the top six.
I was pleased to see him get a big 100 actually, because if he can get through the next 12 months, it completes a really brilliant career, I think, and the career of many different identities. But for him to have come back into this side, came back towards the back end of the Ashes, almost as a kind of a gimme, really, a free hit, and now to have established himself, he's got to go to India where he's never scored runs before, and then he's got to go to England where he's never scored runs before. But if he can pull that off, then it puts the ribbon on a singular career, really. So I was pleased for him. He's an excellent bloke as well.
David Warner's not really scored runs in England or India. He's had a few goes in both places. And I remember Ricky Ponting did an interview with the Great Cricketer before Khawaja got his recall last year. And Ponting said, ever since the day that Khawaja made his test debut in January 2011, Khawaja has been in the top six batters in Australia and should have been the side from that moment on. I do think it's a bit of a shame he's not been persisted with for quite as much of his career. I mean, that's 13 test hundreds now, which draws him level with Damien Martin, for example. He's ahead of Dean Jones, one behind Michael Slater and Ian Chappell. You know, this is a brilliant test career, and he's only had 56 test matches over more than a decade. I think it's a shame that it's only been 56 test matches. He averages more than Warner. They're about the same age, and he's played half as many test matches.
We also barely mentioned Labuschagne, because what can you say about a machine?
Yeah.
You know, what can you say about like an internet router or whatever that is the sort of the centrifugal connecting point of this whole team? He scores runs literally every single week. This, I think, is his 22nd test match at home. He only made 79 in this game, but he's made 900s before that at home in 21 games. He's the fastest. He's the second fastest after Bradman, obviously. Joint second fastest alongside with Everton Weekes to get to 3,000 runs in Test cricket. It all began 3 years ago. And he will return in a few months' time to England where it all began. Hopefully, Jofra Archer will be waiting at the top of his mark.
And it's just a massive year just for so many of those players, because Australia haven't played that much away from home recently. So you got Warner, who was kind of clinging on and now got that double. So I guess he's back in, but that becomes massive for him, the India series and the Ashes. You've got Khawaja, as you say, chance to cement his legacy, but in two places we hasn't seen before. Labuschagne, even though he had that brilliant series against England, he didn't actually make 100 in it, so his away record still pales in comparison to his home record. Steve Smith obviously went through his ebb, maybe coming out of it. And
I think he'll be all right.
Yeah, no, but still, he's got, again, I mean, there's sort of no... He's not been quite that Steve Smith level that we saw dominate the 2016-17 Border Gavaskar Trophy.
But he hit a cover drive and said, I'm back.
Yeah. And then Head has also got a very lopsided record. So you've got a lot of players, actually, who have sort of something to answer. And it could be that Australia come out of the next 8 months as, like, actually a side, obviously not to rank with the great West Indies side or the great Australia side, but maybe in that second rank as being absolutely dominant at home and having gone to two of the toughest places to win away and done it. Or you come out with players who have the same questions over them. So it'll be really, really interesting. The other thing with Labuschagne is he's always fun, even though it's kind of boring.
I agree. I find him compelling to watch.
There was a cute little moment in the test this week where he wanted to fix his helmet, and for some reason he wanted a lighter to do it. So he makes a sort of smoking sign to the pavilion between overs and wasn't brought out a dart, but was brought out a lighter and was able to fix his helmet, which was cute.
There you go. He's
a nice little man.
A nice little man. I'll cement your legacy, Gardner.
Moving on. The Wisden Shop is delighted to announce that the limited edition Cricket Grounds of the UK illustration is now back in stock after it sold out in 24 hours last month. Every single Test and County Championship ground has been included in the largest and most detailed piece of penmanship by artist Ben Staves. In amongst the cricket venues, look out for the towns and cities of the UK, each with their own iconic architectural landmarks. Wisden.com/shop for that. And also a plug for the Wisden Cricket Photograph of the Year competition. We'll leave a link for that in the description as well. Entries close at midnight on Friday. Anyone can enter. The winner gets £1,000, a free Wisden almanac, and a year's subscription to both Wisden Cricket Monthly and the Night Watchman. So get involved there if you've taken some cool snaps in 2022. England Lions have named a couple of squads this week, a test one and an ODI one for their tour of Sri Lanka in January and early February. Big news is Saqib Mahmood is back. He's only played one game of cricket since his test tour of West Indies in 2022. He's in the ODI group. There are a few new names in the test group. Tom Hartley from Lancashire's there, having not played an awful lot of first-class cricket. He's a left-arm spinner. Nathan Gilchrist from Kent, who had a good summer there. Josh Tung from Worcestershire. In the ODI group, there is James Roo, Jacob Bethel and Tom Press, all of whom were in the England under-19 squad last year. Ben, you made the point before we started recording that there are so many English players playing franchise competitions this month that you don't have those guys, so it's kind of the rung below that who are in the ODI group.
Yeah, but they've decided therefore to not to go younger, which is quite exciting. Like Jacob Bethel, who's in that squad, is really interesting, and it'll be fascinating to see how he goes, because what this time last year he was being really, really talked about. He played that that innings in the World Cup quarter final, so in a small chase, but he came out and was, you know, absolutely explosive, and he's been raved about for quite a long time coming through the Warwick system, Barbados born, and they kind of brought him over here, and they I think what the most talented player they've seen come through since Ian Bell was the general assessment, and then he's had an absolute stinker this year, and you wonder if he's looking if he's looking at where he was back then and what's happened to some of the other players who are in that competition, like someone like Javold Brevis, who's gone on to, you know, play in the IPL, made that massive 100 in T20 cricket in South Africa. They were not far off in terms of hype at that point in time, and it's good that, you know, he's in the squad and he has a chance to show why he is deserves to be in that rank, I suppose. And then with the Lions squad, it's quite traditional, isn't it, in a way that is now untraditional for England. I guess a lot of the players that they might be looking at as future Brendan McCullum style test cricketers might be playing T20 cricket at the moment. But still, the fact that there is Josh Bohannon, Alex Lees, Haseeb Ahmed in there, I guess it's good that those guys aren't being forgotten about altogether. And I suppose it'll be interesting to see what happens when England have the choice or have to choose between someone who has a very good first-class record who doesn't fit that profile and someone who is a bit more of a punt but does fit that profile. I mean, at the moment, they basically had the luxury of not having to do that because Brooke is smack bang and Duckett as well are both right in that sweet spot of having both, but there will come a point when they have to choose, and I suppose this suggests that, you know, county runs, even made at whatever pace, still carry some value.
Phil, what were your instant reactions when the email dropped with those two squad announcements?
Nice question. The first thing that jumped out at me was Haseeb Ahmed, not for any great ambitions that he returns to the top of England's order, although I don't think it's completely impossible, but I'm just pleased for him that he's still thought of highly, really. He was so close to falling off the cliff. The other thing I thought was the sheer weight of names that English cricket can call upon. There's so many out there. And if we do have to fill, you know, a dozen bloody T20 leagues every other month, then yeah, a lot are going to be coming from England over the next few years. And if nothing else, we are a good generator of employment in our game. But look, no, there's some, in all seriousness, there's some proper talent in that list. And you'd want to watch all of them. There's intrigue attached to pretty much all of those names. There's one or two names that I'm mildly surprised are in there, and I'm not going to tell you who, because that would be a bit harsh. But there's a lot of names in there that do intrigue me. You know, Jack Haynes at Worcester is a brilliant young player to watch, and he made a lot of runs last year in a struggling side. He made 300s in a row. He's very good to watch. Tom Haynes is in there as well, if you're talking the test squad. Now, you know, he is a sort of Duckett-light, small, compact, lefty, gives it a whack, scores at a good lick, bit up and down, but when he's in, he goes big. They like him as well. I'm glad to see him in the side. He'll probably open with Hamid, you'd imagine. Although Alex Lees is also in there. Jamie Smith as well at Surrey, who I picked last year at the start of the season as a breakout player. He went a bit off and on.
Made a double hundred
against Gloucester, but not much else. But he's a very fine young player. There's stories attached to all of those cricketers, really.
Yeah, kind of on your point, 50 players played for England in 2022 across formats. And I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't a single new face in 2023, because you've got an Ashes series and a World Cup on the horizon. There's not going to be much trying out new guys before then. So many people played in 2022. We kind of know who's about. You might see someone like Rahan Ahmed playing in a format he's not played yet, but I'm not sure we'll see complete newbies. I don't think this is going to happen in 2023, but I keep going back to that depth chart that Mo Bobak put on Sky when he was being interviewed in the South Africa series. The one gap, really, of people who they've got in the pipeline for a possible test spot, I guess, 2 or 3 years down the line, is the wicketkeeper spot. So obviously you've got loads of guys who are good at the same age, the folks, Butler, Bairstow, kind of group, Billings as well. But they're all about 30 to 33 now. I'm really interested to see who the next young wicketkeeper back.
So Ollie Robinson is in that test squad.
Yeah.
Not that Ollie Robinson, the other Ollie Robinson, yeah. The one who's gone up to Durham from Kent. Yeah, the other thing, of course, is the spinners. So you've got here Jack Carson at Sussex, right arm spinner, big lad, gives it a rip, raw but interesting. Hartley, left arm spinner. Liam Paterson-White, left arm spinner. There is no space in this setup for Matt Parkinson. Now, I wonder if it's one of these Lions squads where they sort of know what they've got with him. Mm. They know the good bits, they know the less good bits. Sending him on another trip, another winter sojourn to the middle of nowhere for another run at it, is probably not really going to benefit anybody. So I guess this is probably the next rung down.
Mm. They've said that before as well, that if they know a lot about players, they don't necessarily see the point in doing it. And I think just on the keepers, actually, in the white ball squad, Jordan Cox, who does keep wicket, but not all the time for Kent, part of the reason why Ollie Robinson left Kent, and then also James Rue, who is only, I think he's still only 18, but I wouldn't be so surprised if those two guys become, Rue, this is quite a long way off, but Cox had a very good county championship season last year. I wouldn't be surprised if he's someone who might get named in the squad next winter, for example.
And Rue is a long way off, but am I right in thinking he played in that in a county select game against the India touring team?
He did.
So they clearly rate his glove work at least for him to get into that. So
England Women's T20 World Cup squad is announced, we think, tomorrow. So we'll talk about that in depth on next week's show. On to the BBL. It's not often that the BBL is a centre of attention these days, but it managed it twice in a couple of days this week. There were two quite controversial incidents. Ben, do you want to briefly explain what they were? So one was a boundary catch and one was a man catch.
The six most depressing words to hear in the new year is controversy, mild controversy in the Big Bash League. Let's go, Ben.
Seven words, that.
Mild controversy in the Big Bash. Take off the league.
Okay.
Classic stuff.
The Nisa catch wasn't really controversial in terms of the laws.
The laws are very clear.
The laws are clear and they were followed to the letter. He took a catch inside the rope, threw it up, stepped out to the field of play, did a little hop, palmed it back into play, stepped back in and took the catch. Some people have an issue with it basically because they have two sort of objections. One is that they don't like that thing is allowed, and the other is that they concoct really weird scenarios of what this means you can do. Like, oh, you could just keep on jumping and palming it up in the air infinitely or whatever, and it's like, you could do that, but like, why would anyone ever want to, you know?
And also like people saying that you could start in the crowd, but you can't because you need your first foot needs to be in field of play.
First of all, you can't. Second of all, you also wouldn't want to, right? Like like imagine having to traverse a big bash crowd while you're trying to like take a catch, you know.
There's no one there.
Yeah, well, some of the crowd's been all right, but imagine.
Oh, I'm joking, Christ.
You end up with your foot in a bucket of chicken and you're stepping over a mullet and that sort of thing, it'd be a nightmare.
So, that wasn't the controversial one?
No, the Adams Amper one was a bit more controversial. Adams Amper attempted to run out Tom Rogers at the non-striker's end before bowling the ball, and it was ruled not out because Zampa had gone through his sort of delivery arc with his arm without releasing the ball before turning back to knock off the stumps. There were a few bits of controversy. Obviously, there was the standard stuff around these types of dismissals where people debate, should this be allowed? Should it not? Should there be a warning? All that sort of thing, which is kind of, well, boring to me at least. What's more interesting is the interpretation of the law around, firstly, what is meant by the expected point of release, which the MCC have now clarified they mean the highest point in a bowler's action before delivery. They can't say vertical because that might, you know, rule out Lassith Malinga, for example, and that sort of thing.
But then you spoke to Fraser Stewart, who's the head of laws at the MCC, or head of cricket, but he's also the laws guru, as he describes in his own Twitter account. I think, Ben, you put across your opinions very well. I thought after your chat with Phil about Crawley last week, this had the potential to get a bit messy. Anyway, here is that conversation.
Before we get into the decisions over the past week, I wanted to try and work out what the process for adding or changing a law in the law of cricket is. So I was wondering, is it just you sort of who oversees the whole thing, or is there a kind of a group of you? I wondered if the World Cricket Committee were involved much, and just what the sort of the consultation process is from realizing like this is something that needs to change to the final wording that goes in the law book.
Yeah, well, thankfully for everyone, it's not just down to me. We've got actually quite a robust process. Obviously, we're constantly watching the game and seeing how the game evolves. And at MCC, we have a wide committee structure. And sort of, I guess, going from the bottom up, we have the laws subcommittee, which sits twice a year and has representatives from the international game and sort of from the recreational game. So you have to remember that although most of the cricket that's seen, you know, by people is at the professional sharp end, the majority of cricket that's played, the vast majority of cricket that's played, is, you know, in a park on an afternoon with just 22 players and two umpires and no TV cameras. So we do have to make sure that the laws are for the whole game and not just suitable for the top level. So, yeah, we have the laws subcommittee, which contains about 10 people. Sort of more well-known names would include Simon Torfall, Sundaram Ravi, Claire Polosak from Australia has just joined. So we've got a wide range of people spread around the world, and they meet four times a year, and we sort of review what's been going on in the game and look at all the laws and see whether they're fit for purpose and whether any, you know, need to sort of go on the to-do list for things to change. Then sitting above the law subcommittee, we have the MCC Cricket Committee, which is a mainly sort of UK-based body sort of that discusses all things related to MCC cricket. But then we also have the World Cricket Committee, which is perhaps the best known of all the MCC's committees. And that contains the sort of the great and good, if you like, of the world game. So current members include Kumar Sangakkara, Justin Langer and Graham Smith have both just come on. We've got Alistair Cook, Mike Gatting chairs it, Susie Bates is on it, Claire Connor's just come on it. So it's a real stellar collection of people from all around the world, and they meet normally twice a year and discuss all sorts of things relating to the game of cricket, but a lot of them are laws related. They enjoy the laws chats actually around and getting into the detail. And so quite often the policy will more be set by the World Cricket Committee and the Cricket Committee. And then that feeds back down to the laws subcommittee, where we have a sort of a drafting group within that subcommittee, who will then try and get the desired policy sort of onto paper in as clear and as coherent as way possible. So there's a lot of input goes into it. We make sure that we get international input. And then when we have a sort of a big change, like we had in 2017, where we had a new code of laws, we will quite often go out to governing bodies with sort of questionnaires and kind of take the temperature of what people are think about the game and any changes they think should be made. And then all the feedback we get from that, because that will normally cascade from an umpires manager in a country, that will go down to players and umpires at recreational and professional level. So we'll get a view of what people think about the game, what laws that they may be happy with, which ones they're less happy with. And then that will then, you know, feed into our decisions as to whether a change is necessary.
Within that process, so once you've got a wording of a law that you think you're happy with, is there like a stress testing thing? Like, because one thing that cricket doesn't do that other sports do, as far as I'm aware, is having sort of like trial periods for laws too much. Is it mostly that you just kind of work out between you that you think that you try and go through every eventuality, or is there?
Some things are trialled by playing regulations, and we do have a close relationship with the ECB, partly sort of geographically, and some things that we put in the laws are sort of trialled as ECB playing regulations before then. When we used to run university cricket in the UK, we quite often used the cricket in their competitions just as a bit of a petri dish, if you like, to try out new things to see whether they worked or not. We consult with ICC very closely as well. Jamie Cox and before him John Stevenson has sat on the ICC cricket committee, and so we work very closely with ICC as well to sense check things with them. And you know, often things will get will be trialled either internationally or otherwise in more local leagues to see whether they work.
Yeah, okay. And I was wondering about the relationship with the ICC, because I wonder if more. I mean, well, you see it a lot when cricketers will say like the ICC need to do something about it, and they actually mean the MCC need to change this or that. Do you think that is that independence? Is that's a good thing? Do you think that you have you're so focused on this one thing rather than having, you know, a million things on your plate, and also you're just kind of, I don't know, there's less political influence on the MCC, I suppose. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think we have a fine balance. We are independent and neutral, which I think is a great asset for a body that holds the laws. But we also, you know, through particularly the creation of the World Cricket Committee and in more recent years, a more sort of international flavour to our laws subcommittee, we want to make sure that we are truly global. Yes, we're based at Lord's in London, but we are a global club. We have members all around the world. We play cricket all around the world. And we want to make sure that the input we're getting is not just a very Anglo-centric way, one, but one that reflects the way that cricket is played in different countries. And that's indeed the case. The cricket on a village green here, you know, might be played very differently from how it's played in perhaps Australia or in India or Pakistan or wherever. And we need to take all that into consideration and make sure that we take a global view on things and not just a sort of perhaps an English one.
Mm. And if you don't mind me saying, you yourself have a very powerful position within the game. I know there are lots of checks and balances, but in terms of what cricket actually looks like, that's determined by the laws, essentially. When you step down, whenever that is, what's the process for appointing the next MCC head of cricket? How can we be sure they'll be sort of as good as it as you are?
Oh, the recruitment procedure at MCC is very robust, and whenever a position becomes available, it's sort of advertised, and there's a proper process that goes through. My position has kind of evolved over the years that I've been at MCC. I started off running the cricket office, all MCCs, the cricket that MCCs played, but I was did a law degree and got a background in law. So I then sort of moved into a laws position and have gradually sort of moved up and the laws have come with me. So, I played a lot of amateur cricket. I sort of know the game from that level. And then, more latterly have become involved in cricket at a higher level as well as an administrator. So yeah, I think I'm quite well covered to do the role, but as and when I move on, I'm sure there'll be someone equally or better skilled to be able to carry on the role.
Okay. Well, let's get down into the nitty-gritty of the two decisions this week. Let's start with the NISA catch. And I wanted to talk about it because I wanted to ask what kind of influences how the laws are worded, if that makes sense. And in that instance, the laws are completely clear. There's no sort of fault with them. It says that your final contact with the ground before your first contact with the ball has to be within the field of play, and then from then on, as long as you're not in contact with the ball and the ground at the same time, you're fine. So people's objections, which there have been some, are essentially sort of aesthetic, right? It's about how they want the catch to look. In those cases, how much do you listen to public opinion, and how much is it, this is how we think it should be, how much is it, this is what the committees above us have said it should look like, and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's all good points. And I think that the point to raise is, yes, there's been some concerns raised about the legality of the catch and not the umpire's interpretation of anything. Everyone's clear that the umpire got it right as per the laws. There's just some people questioning whether the law itself is right. And that's fair for them to do. We think it is. This is a law that we've worked on quite a lot since 2010. Since particularly the sort of the rise of T20. We've seen a rise in athleticism of fielding on the boundary. And we've tried to sort of evolve the laws to cater for that rather than to outlaw it. We think that these bits of fielding are good for the game. They're really exciting. You see some, you know, some tremendous bits of athleticism from the players in both the male and female games. And it's something that we felt, you know, is good for the game. There's a lot of talk more generally about the balance of the game and perhaps favouring the batters a bit too much. You know, the bats are getting more powerful, the attacking play, the boundaries are getting brought in and shorter. So we feel that the wording of the current law, whilst it may perhaps grate with some, is a fair law, because you can't be grounded outside and in contact with the ball at the same time. So the key thing is the first contact must be from within the boundary, or if you're airborne, that you took off from within the boundary. So we don't want people standing 10 yards behind the boundary and then having their first impact there and sort of bunny hopping it but back in. So the game starts off within the boundary. We've seen all sorts of different catches like this. There was one that Matt Renshaw did a couple of years ago in the Big Bash. Well, Matt Renshaw started it and a teammate finished it, because he took it inside, threw it up, went over, and then sort of jumped up like Nisa did and parried it back. But instead of parrying it to himself, he parried it to a teammate who completed the catch. And there was less fuss about that than there was about Nisa's one. But actually, from a law's perspective, they've done pretty much the same thing. They were sort of inside, and then they were outside, and they jumped up and patted it back. So I think we are happy with the law as it currently stands. We have these committees, as I mentioned earlier, that will review this and check that we think it's right. But it was very exciting for the game. It was a brilliant bit of quick thinking and rare skill. You know, this doesn't happen very often. This law has been like this since 2013, and you can count on less than five fingers probably the number of times that it's really happened in exactly this way. And it's good for the game, and the fielder is rewarded for some a great bit of fielding.
Yeah, and for knowing the laws as well. Nisa, he said after the game that he'd remembered the Renshaw catch, and so for that reason was why he attempted what he did. And it's good to see players being aware of the laws. I guess an example of a player maybe not being so aware is the attempted Adam Zampa run out from the other day. And there are a few things to talk about here. Again, if you haven't seen it, Adam Zampa went to run out Melbourne Renegades Tom Rogers at the non-striker's end before he bowled the ball. But although Rogers was out of his ground, he was given not out because Zampa's arm had passed the expected point of delivery before the wicket was put down. So first, let's talk about that clause, expected point of delivery. There was a statement on the MCC website yesterday that said this has long been defined by the MCC as the highest point in the bowler's action. So I guess my question is, why do the laws not say that?
The laws have said as been drafted as they are pretty much since 2017. We have actually moved the law to the run out law from the unfair play law just recently, last October. But the expected point of release rather than the highest point. That's the way it was drafted at the time. I think if we in a future iteration of the law, we might look to clarify that a bit closer. But I think most people are aware when the expected moment of release is. It's when the arm sort of gets up there and when the ball is going to come out. We don't use the word vertical because not all bowling actions come with a vertical arm, but at the highest point, we kind of, if you see a bowling action, you know when you think the ball is pretty much going to be released, and it's roughly when the ball is up at the top. So we say we use that point because what we want non-strikers to try and stay on their ground for as long as possible, but we don't want the one a bit like Zampa did, and he didn't seem to be aware of the law, which is fine. No fingers pointed at him. But what we don't want is the bowler going sort of through with the bowling action. And, once you see the arm sort of up at the top and then coming back down, the non-striker has a reasonable belief that the ball, will have been delivered by then and will probably sort of, move out of his ground, and we don't want the bowler then coming back round and doing the sort of the run out on the way back. So that's not something we want. But this law is, you know, it's always controversial, you know, when it happens. But MCC has been quite firm and hasn't moved its stance for a while on this. You know, the bowler is often castigated as the villain of the piece. But it's the non-striker who started all this emotion by potentially leaving their ground early. And MCC's message to non-strikers has been and will continue to be, you know, this can all be avoided very simply if you just stay on your ground a little bit longer, watch the bowler's release point, make backing up a bit more of an active thing rather than a sort of passive just meandering out when the bowler's roughly there. Just actually focus, watch the bowler's delivery action. When the ball's released or when the arm is at the top, that's when you're safe to leave the ground and you can head out. And I think if non-strikers did that, there would be, you know, be far fewer incidents of these and it would all go a bit quieter.
Yeah, and can I just ask a very specific thing about the Zampa run out, which relates to all of this? So as I read that first sentence, I'll just read it out of that law. So it says, if the non-striker is out of his or her ground at any time from the moment the ball comes into play until the instant when the bowler would normally have been expected to release the ball, the non-striker is liable to run out. So that suggests to me that the key thing is when the non-striker leaves their ground, not when the run out has to happen, if that makes sense. So if we're just to switch just some of the words around, for me, if a parent said to their child, if you come downstairs from now until I finish making dinner, you are liable to be punished, I don't think it's implied in there that the punishment will come before they finish making dinner, if that makes sense. I don't know if that's quite a convoluted example, if that's clued anything up at all. But do you see what I'm saying?
I do, and we've actually been looking at that this week, and I can see how people can be confused by that. There is the first three words of the next sentence are in these circumstances, which and then goes on to explain it, which tries to sort of qualify it a bit. But the MCC's intention has always been clear that it's not about. Effectively, the run out has to happen before the arm gets up there, rather than if the non-striker leaves before the arm gets up there, the run out can then take place even if it's later. So we've been looking at that, you know, this week in light of this, because I think some people are just not reading the law wrongly, but just perhaps just as you mentioned there, just getting not quite. Getting the emphasis as we would like it. So there's perhaps a bit of tidying up there just to make it clear. In our eyes, that wouldn't be changing the law in any way. It would really perhaps just getting the wording a bit better so that it's a bit clearer for everyone. But the key thing is until the arm, the bowler has to try to affect the run out before the arm gets to the vertical. Once the arm's got to the vertical, it's too late for there to be a run out.
Thanks, Fraser. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Not at all. It's very nice to see you.
Jonathan asked, disappointed in your chat last week. You didn't mention 2010 as a contender for the best ever year of English men's cricket. England drew away to a strong South Africa. There's a T20 World Cup win. There's a dominant home summer. And they were 2-1 up against Australia in the away Ashes by the end of the year. I guess fair enough, but it wasn't a vintage home summer. The opposition wasn't great. So yeah, that's probably why we didn't include it.
All I remember at home summer is Cook getting a rubbish 100, but then scoring loads of runs after it, right?
Well, he scored the 100 at the Oval when his position was supposedly under threat, yeah. And he got to 100 because Asif just tried to throw the ball to the keeper, but threw it over the keeper's head.
And 05 as well. I don't remember this conversation at all. It was in the midst of the so-called festive period.
Yeah.
I dialed that one in. So-called festive period. Well, you know, I mean, it's not always festive, is it?
The so-called Big Six.
it doesn't always feel especially festive, that's all. The period. It was during the period. I don't remember the conversation at all, but I think 05 definitely deserves more of a shout than it maybe got at the time. Yeah. The fact that they did go to South Africa, that incredible series against the callous, stained Smith side, and to win that series was astonishing. And then obviously we all know what happened that summer. I can't remember if Pakistan...
Was that year?
My question. There's the fly in the ointment then.
Yeah. Is there anything from that podcast you do remember?
I remember having a lovely time.
Okay, that's good.
It's more you can say for this one.
Mike asks, should we care about the SA20 league? What's the significance of all the teams being owned
by IPL franchises? Of course you should, Mike. Absolutely.
Well, if you look at the list of players, it's quite odd not to get excited about it. Phil's going to have a go, but it's a great list of players. It's going to be quite easy to watch, relatively speaking, in the UK. It's on Sky, obviously. Not that many people have Sky, but that's a better starting point than most cricket at the moment. So I'm going to watch it.
You're right. Well, okay, sod it. So am I. I'm terrified about losing the game. Terrified about the game shifting its complexion so much that I don't really recognise it anymore. And so in the spirit of wanting to keep it close to my heart and my mind, I am going to have to give this stuff more of a go. I did it with the IPL. I got over the line with that a few years ago. I'm now well into that. I find it a bit harder with the other leagues, in part because I don't necessarily know how to access them, right? And there's issues around television coverage as well and it being spread ever more across different channels and so on. But look, I don't want this game to drift through my fingers. And so if this is what it's going to look like increasingly, I don't want South African cricket to go to the wall, and I don't want it to go to the wall with me being apathetic to it, right? So if this is a necessary result of financial tribulations, if you like, and if perhaps this thing can be set up and then it can bring about a better day 2 or 3 years down the line, then I'm certainly not going to turn my nose up at it, or rather, I'm going to try not to turn my nose up at it. You didn't see that answer coming, did you? But there you go.
No.
Does it make sense to you, though?
It does. I mean, we'll get into...
In short, if you can't beat it, join it.
Well, yeah. And also, like, I think in isolation, these T20 leagues are really good. It's more, I think the people's distrust of them is more kind of the overarching domination of them. But the actual competition is quite often very good. Some of them are rubbish, you know.
I'm going to treat it like Serie A or La Liga. You know, I'll dip in here and there. I'll catch a bit on the social medias.
What's El Clasico?
I think it's Pearl Royals versus MI Cape Town. They're the two favourites with the bookies, I'm pretty sure. yeah, I guess...
MI Cape Town will have the likes of...
Rashid Khan, Kagiso Rabada, Brevis, Sam Curran, Livingston, Rassie van der Dusen, Ryan Rickleton, George Linder, Buran Hendricks.
George Linder, your mate? Didn't you go out on the drink with him?
Once.
Joffre Archer is there, is he, or not?
Joffre Archer, Ollie Stone, Odine Smith, and your mate, Grant Rolofson. So I guess we've got to be...
Is he in it as well?
He's
going to be the star of the show. To be fair, that is a team. If you're halfway interested in short form cricket, you'd want to watch that side.
And then Par Royals, they got David Miller, Josh Butler, Obed McCoy, Lungi Ngidi, Tabrai Shamsi, Jason Roy, Dane Villas... Owen Morganston around, Andile Pefelekweo. Like honestly, that is one of the best lists of players that any T20 competition has. I think if you're a non-English fan, I think you'd say this is quite a lot more exciting than the 100 as a list of players.
Mm. If this podcast...
Indisputably, yeah.
Yeah.
This podcast maybe should just be listing players and going like, oh, wow, that sounds good. yeah, I guess...
It has basically been that, hasn't it? Tom Ains.
Guys, we just sit around listing names and it's fun. I guess the thing with the SA20 thing, and it's kind of echoing what Phil says, but it's tricky because from a macroeconomic point of view, these leagues are kind of... fascinating to see how they pan out, what it means, the direction of travel. Does this succeeding mean more power for the IPL or what? But then also, actually, if you want South African cricket to be a going concern and to have a competitive South Africa side, does that mean that you have to want this type of competition to succeed? It probably does, if only for the financial side of things. And also because there is the potential that this is the proving ground for the next generation of South African white ball stars who, you know, are competitive at World Cups, obviously, and end up feeding into other leagues that we do get excited about. Whether that means that I will be invested in who Pearl Royals pick at number six for their opener or whatever, I find it hard to say. But
I think you will.
Do you think?
I don't find it hard to say. I think by week three you will.
As an aside, Yaz.
Yes.
Seeing as it's the new year.
Mm.
By the way, this is the 20th year, 20th calendar year that I've been doing this job.
Wow.
Let that one sink in. Anyway, phrases to ban, and I'd like the listeners to write in, send us messages, whatever, phrases that they'd like us to ban,
mm-hmm.
and there should be some sort of penalty for using them. Now, Garda didn't know that I'm banning direction of travel for the year. He didn't know that, so I can't penalise you because he didn't know. But I'm banning that one. Okay, I'm putting a big black line through that one. And I want our punters to email in, write in, tweet us in.
This could get messy.
Yeah, for sure. But I think it's better this way.
It's my eighth year, Phil. How does that make you feel?
No, it's not. You've been doing this about 3 years.
2016 was my first foray.
Really?
Mm. Wow.
Turning up in your clown kit and all the rest of it.
As I still have, yeah.
You've really grown into it, Ben.
Thanks. From shaky beginnings.
Moving on. Bit of news this week from Zimbabwe. Gary Balance, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, he has been named in Zimbabwe's T20I squad for their upcoming series against Ireland. He never played for England in T20I cricket, but played a handful of ODIs in 2013, 2014 and 2015. We're not going to do this discussion again because we kind of did it 2 or 3 weeks ago when the announcement was made that he would be returning to Zimbabwe. So if you want to hear our thoughts on that, scroll back a couple of episodes. Ben, your moment of the week.
Yes, well, I sort of had two.
But it's the funny one.
Okay, all right. So I presume you discussed on last week's show the machinations at the top of the Pakistan Cricket Board with Ramiz Raja axed as PCB chair and Najam Sethi coming in as PCB chair between two test series. There's a six-day gap, but they got a lot done.
We didn't talk about that, but... Thank you for the update.
Presumably he's doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence there, Garvin.
Well, so it's a 6-day gap between test series, but they got a lot done. And since then, it's just been very, very fun to watch the bitching and the bickering on social media, basically. I mean, Ramiz Raja was still doing his YouTube videos while he was in charge of the PCB and is now doing that essentially full time. So you'll see all these quotes circulating with him saying one thing, and then you'll see sort of a rebuttal coming from another source. And lots of the tweets have just been quite funny. So Najam Sethi tweeted out this really, really long list of stuff. So it's a graphic with the three names of him, the PCB chair that followed him, and Ramiz Raja, and listing basically everything that he felt he'd done really well in his first in charge, and everything that he felt the other two had done really badly in their times in charge. So in the Ramiz Raja column, it had infighting at its peak was one of the things, which is quite an ironic thing to tweet when you've taken time to put together a graphic slagging off everyone else.
Quite a good graphic as well.
Yeah, it was. Weirdly, he didn't list exceptional graphic design skills in his own column. And then Ramiz Raja is sort of he's trying to rebut lots of things. There's a lot of it is quite dense, swirling around like the Pakistan Junior League and whether that was a good idea and whatever. But he was trying to tweet out lots of screenshots from a document and got it wrong. And so then also tweeted like, sorry, I'll tweet them all again in order. And that's the only one that's got loads of likes, but no one cares about all the other stuff. There was a tweet of a photo of loads of clutter on a desk, kind of what our office looks like at any given day, stuff like a plastic basketball on the table and a sort of a shortbread tin with in the shape of a double-decker bus, saying that Ramiz Raja has left all the stuff at the PCB offices and isn't coming back to collect it to prolong the dispute. Maybe they should settle it by getting the plastic basketball, setting up two miniature basketball hoops, and sort of some kind of grudge match. That's the only solution I can see.
It'd be a great TV chat between the two of them. Just
air it all out.
Yeah.
We have an interview actually with Najam Sethi in the upcoming issue of the magazine. And he is quite a character, judging by this particular interview that he's given to one of our new writers, a lad called William Dobson, who's done a really good job on it actually. He still has, not William, he still has 24-hour police protection.
Really?
Due to... his years as a journalist and things that he'd said and written about the Taliban. And so this job at the PCB is probably going to be a cakewalk considering what he's put up with for much of his life. Turned down a PhD from Cambridge to devote himself to Pakistani public life. Thorn in the side of Imran during Imran's premiership. It's not going to be dull, this tenure. Let's put it that way.
Definitely. We're going to finish the show by looking forward to 2023, asking for our hopes and dreams for the new year. Keep them cricket specific, please. And keep them brief because we've gone on for quite a while. We've still got to hear from Butch as well.
Big edit needed on this one.
I know. Phil, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, all right. Very quickly then. From the top, just jotted these things down. Anyone but Australia to win the Women's World T20. happening in South Africa. I hope it's well attended and well followed. Happening in the middle of February, as you say, the England squad gets announced Friday morning. We'll talk about that next week. Some interesting bits in it, though, from what I've heard. Anyway, anyone but Australia to win it. Nothing against them; they're an amazing side. But that World Game needs a change. It needs some other side to put their hand up. And obviously, in 20 over cricket, there's more chance of a so-called upset than anywhere else. Essex to win the CC, of course, with Dan Lawrence to make 1,200 runs. Me to still remember how to bat on a Saturday afternoon. I'd like that. The Test final, this is a big one for me. The Test final to be a humdinger and also a sellout. It's here at the Oval, first week in June. Don't care who's playing in it. I just want it to be a real classic, a showpiece. The last one, it was a good finish, but it was a six-day game condensed into three because it pissed down in Southampton. We want more than that this time round.
Yeah.
And finally, the West Indies men's side just to turn up, literally turn up, to the World Cup in India, but also to do well.
Yeah.
If Test cricket is finished in the West Indies, and that conclusion is ever harder to avoid, then it still has to have some kind of vibrancy, some sort of relevance in the world game. White ball cricket is the only way through. It was horrifying to watch them so disjointed last time out in the T20 in Australia. And so, yeah, crossing everything that they can get something out of that tournament in India, not to win it necessarily, but just to reinstitute a little bit of pride and class into everybody's second favourite cricketing culture.
Yeah, that was very good, Phil. My one sounds quite broad. I want the cricket that's played to be really, really good, and with a focus on two specific series. So the Border Gavaskar Trophy and the Ashes, I think both.
What, you only care about the big three?
Well, yeah. No, but given the lack of long test series elsewhere, those are the two that have the chance to be real all-time great test series. And I really think they do. Like that, India obviously had that home dominance for so long, but if any team in any situation was going to challenge them, it would be this Australia side riding high as they are now. So that has the potential to be really, really good, but it also might not be. You might just find that India can roll out some surfaces which help their spinners. Aussie spinners can't really compete and their batters can't find the solutions. And it ends up being actually the kind of series that ends up being disappointing with a lot of hype around it. The Ashes, I actually think whichever way it goes, it'll be really interesting and really fun. But I just basically want everyone to be fit, essentially. Like I'm already envisioning in my head, you know, the battle between, you know, Pat Cummins and Johnny Bairstow or Zach Crawley against Mitchell Starc or Josh Hazlewood or whoever it is. But if there are players who you know, lose form or don't make it, or it's just there is something diminishing it, that would be a real shame when it has everything set up to be a classic, I think.
So I got four, two around my own cricket and then two around the world game, no, three around the world game. So one, I want to take 26 league wickets this season because that'll get me up to 100 for my club.
That's lovely.
And you get a cap if you get to 100.
Do you?
Yeah.
That's class.
I think we might have a new leg spinner playing for the twos this year.
Useful. You'll pick up a lot of his wickets.
His brother listens to the pod. So this is a direct message. You know who you are. Get your brother to play. He's going to take so many wickets for us this season. And then a thought I've had during the Football World Cup, the Darts World Championship and the T20 Blast. Quarterfinals are just great in sport. That's when the competition gets really good. And the Blast quarterfinals are always brilliant. And I think more needs to be made out of that. Like every year, the crowds are really up for it. The cricket's really good. So I hope this year, maybe it's too soon for it to happen in 2023, but going forward, people at the ECB just realise this is one of our best products. Put this on the BBC. This is a better TV product than the 100. It just is. They've got it and they've basically done nothing with it for years. You know, I'd mentioned the darts, but part of the reason why people love that Michael Smith 9 darter is the crowd goes mental. The crowd gets so into Blast quarterfinals. It's county cricket that actually matters in front of packed houses. There's some brilliant ones this year. There's brilliant ones last year. So I hope that happens. I want Australia to win the first test of the Ashes because I think that'll just make it a more interesting series. And then the more serious one is just an active movement from somewhere to revitalise test cricket. Kind of going on what we were talking about earlier, I'm open-minded about T20 cricket. I actually like it. I really like the IPL. I really like the PSL. But the looming domination does freak me out a little bit. And I think it's already gone that way, it's already too imbalanced. Like this New Zealand Pakistan series that's on now, you've got Trent Bolt playing the BBL at the moment over a test match where New Zealand desperately take 20 wickets. Lachie Ferguson would be absolutely ideal for this test series. He hasn't made a first class game in 3 years. If they were English, they'd be playing. And I think we've already got to that point where test cricket is already a fair bit worse because of the financial imbalance. So just someone powerful from somewhere to do something to realise this is quite good. I don't think that's too much to ask for.
Do you really want Australia to win the first test?
Yeah, I think I do.
On your serious point, your strokey beard point, I want the ICC's voices to be louder this year. I want them to articulate the reality of their jobs. And I want them to explain to us why these decisions are being made and how much agency they actually have over the decisions that are made, how much power they have to push through South Africa not playing a test match for 3 years, a three test series for 3 years, how much power they have to push through or block or urge against the West Indies playing six test matches in 2023. I'd like to hear from them, and I'd like them to be up front for once about the nature of their jobs, the nature of the landscape as it seems, because we don't know. We really, truly don't know. Is there a huge pile of money that's not being used to replenish the test game and to replenish the players' pockets to persuade them to be more engaged with it? Or is there no money for it? Is it the case that the money has been necessarily spread so far and wide across emergent nations that there's not that much money left for the top echelons of full member test playing nations? Why does Ireland and Afghanistan have test status if they don't want to play it because they lose money hand over fist? How can that possibly have got to, how can we have got to this point, and how do we get out of it? I'd like to hear from them. That's my actual New Year's wish.
The statistic for me that's most sobering on the future tours program that was what announced a few months ago is that in the newly announced series for that, every series of four or more matches was played between two of England, India and Australia. Every series of three or more matches involved one of England, India, Australia. Mm. And every other series was two matches or less.
So three test series literally don't exist unless the big three are playing.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's hear what Butch hopes for in 2023. Happy New Year, Butch. What are your hopes and dreams for 2023?
Well, then, that is a wide-ranging question. Do you want me to keep it to cricket or not?
To cricket.
Hopes and dreams cricket-wise for 2023. Well, I mean, trying to widen it out as much as possible. I really hope that, having watched quite a lot of the New Zealand Pakistan series, that's halfway through or nearly three quarters of the way through that the second and final test match. I really hope that some of this sort of aggressive, gung ho, losing test matches doesn't matter attitude starts to rub off elsewhere. And it's got nothing to do with England, actually. I mean, obviously, England are doing it already. But I just think that for the game and for the sport as a whole, it would be a magnificent thing. So I'd love to see more of that. I hope that, and I'm pretty sure that will continue apace during the Ashes anyway, just simply because of the macho-ness of the two nations going against one another. So that's something to look forward to. I hope that the qualifications for the World Cup throw up great interest. I mean, we're in a scenario now where, you know, where Ireland could find themselves in the top eight to qualify, leaving South Africa, Sri Lanka and the West Indies having to battle out for two spots in the qualification. Now, how extraordinary would that be? So, you know, there are all kinds of interesting sort of subplots around what happens before the World Cup in India in October. And then again, I hope, the game does something to showcase itself in a magnificent way throughout the course of that tournament. Obviously, it's going to be huge. You know, the Indian public will come out and support it in their droves. It requires India, I think, to go all the way to the final. And there'll be a lot of countries around the place that hope that doesn't happen for one reason or another, whether that be financial jealousy or jealousy of any other type. But that'll be something to really look forward to, I hope. Again, you know, the 50 over format, I suppose, when looking at it through the 2019 lens of being English, or being a former England player, or being an England cricket fan, England and Wales cricket fan, you know, that resurrected the format, right? Of course, but if you look at it from elsewhere, from other people's point of view, that's not necessarily the case. So again, a big World Cup, a great World Cup, is required in order to kind of to keep eyes on 50 over cricket. Otherwise, and this might not be a bad thing anyway, otherwise we might find ourselves with a format, another format, which is battling hard to stay relevant. So there's lots at stake.
I think it could be, in a weird way, like the last normal-ish year of international cricket as we know it, because as you say, 50 over cricket is going to go through some kind of change between 2023 and 2027, one would suspect. Even from an English Test cricket point of view, home Ashes summer, but next summer England are playing two relatively weak sides at home. So I almost feel like this is a year to really savour whilst it's here. Because things might not look like this again.
No, you're right. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of other things at play. The idea that the five Test match Ashes series is going to be sandwiched into, you know, little more than 5 weeks is, I mean, that in itself creates, I mean, it'll create a lot of interest, but it might create a lot of issues around whether both teams are able to put their best teams out on the park. And it might end up being survival of the fittest at the end. You know, I think we had it the last time, didn't we? After the World Cup, in fact, that it was that the whole thing was sandwiched into a very small small period of time. And you know, one of the things, I suppose, the nostalgic in me, the nostalgia fan in me, sort of looks back to old Ashes series, or watching it when I was a kid, and having the narrative spread out over the course of the summer. Well, that we're not going to get that, and you know, unlikely to get that sort of thing ever again. So you know, it's important that goes extremely well. It's also then, I think, very important for lots and lots of different reasons that the 100 kind of goes off with a bit more of a bang than it did last year. I think that the general feeling was that it didn't back up year one particularly well, and lots of people will be very unhappy about the fact that it is kind of that it seems to have sandwiched the Ashes into that smaller window, and so therefore there's quite a bit of pressure on the 100 to deliver during the course of what is going to be a rather big August for it, you know. And I kind of, there are lots and lots of reasons why people are rightly upset about the 100 and its place in the English cricket calendar. And there are all sorts of reasons why, if it doesn't succeed, that could be very problematic for the game going forward. So you've got to kind of hold your nose and hope that it goes brilliantly well, I think, on the back of a memorable Ashes series.
There's absolutely loads to look forward to in 2023. And I think we all look forward to seeing how it plays out. Cheers for your time, Butch. That is all we have time for on today's show.
That flew by.
Well done, Phil. Well done, Ben. We'll be back next week where we have an interview, hopefully, with one of England's best bowlers at Pakistan. Sports Social Podcast Network.